Okay, I got the red smoke.
Gun runs north and south, west of the smoke, west of the smoke.
Okay, copy, west of the smoke. I'm looking at danger close now.
Come on, win it, baby, give it to me, I need it. You're cleared hot.
Copy, cleared hot.
Boom, boom, boom. Here we go. Full Auto Friday number 15. I'm going to start with, I can't believe I've actually been at this for 15 weeks, which, what does that break into? Almost 4 months. Remember the first one like it was 4 months ago. Today, I got four questions laid out, and then I'm going to finish with a little bit more polling from Twitter. But what I did is I scrolled all the way to the bottom so I could answer the unanswered portion from last week, so I don't have to solicit for questions again, because I feel like if I do that and the questions didn't get answered, it'll be the same question over and over and over again. Before I start today's Full Auto Friday, I feel compelled, for personal reasons, nothing beyond personal reasons, to address some of the commentary posted on both the social post and YouTube that I got from this week, Monday's episode 141 with Angel Cortez. Talked a little bit about my current relationship with my oldest son. And a few people took the time to reach out and let me know that I deserved what's going on with my son because I had abandoned him. And I wanted to get my thoughts in order. So what I did is I actually wrote a letter to those individuals who took the time to give me their thoughts on the fact that I deserve the relationship I currently have with my son. So here is what I was able to write out. And I'm not going to lie, I was a little bit frustrated when I started reading those comments. Dear podcast listeners / viewers who took the time to provide your thoughts on whether or not I deserve what is happening with my son. Go fuck yourself. And that's it. That's the end of the letter. That's as far as I've gotten. And I don't think I'm going to get any farther because that is how I feel. I do the best that I can to take the negative with the positive when it comes to any feedback. I don't think that people should weigh positive more than negative. And oftentimes I see people weighing negative far more than positive. 99 positive comments, one negative, and the reaction hinges on that. But I tell you what, there's certain things that get underneath my skin, and perhaps this is one of them for me, and maybe that's a deficiency in my own character. But I am often blown away by people's arrogance and ignorance when it comes to what they will say on the internet. I've been very, very cautious when it comes to my divorce to say nothing specific and only talk about things directly related to something that I have done. I will not talk about it unless the other party is here to have their opportunity to speak about it. So I've been very cautious. And with the amount of information that I have given out, there is no way that anybody anywhere knows enough about the situation that I am in, or the health or unhealthiness of the previous relationship that I have gotten out of, or the decisions that I have made, the things that led up to me making the decision to leave, to make that type of commentary. So if you're one of those people, I don't know what to say other than I hope you go to the dick buffet and get a big old serving and eat those, because you're an asshole. You're arrogant and you ought to be cautious with what you say to people. I am very cautious with the words that I use, even though the dialogue and the commentary that I am having when it comes to these podcasts, specifically these Full Auto Fridays, is one way. Words, they actually matter to people. They have real-world impact. The things that you say, they matter. And I wish that more people would take the time to consider those things. And for those who can't, get a second serving at the dick buffet. And that's all I got on that. Let's move on. Let us begin Full Auto Friday. Question number one comes from James. Hi, Andy. You have inspired me to start my jiu-jitsu journey after procrastinating for years. I wish I had started sooner. In parentheses, he's 42. I know exactly how you feel because I started when I was 40. So you're only 2 years behind me. I am a couple of months into jiu-jitsu, and I was wondering, as a blue belt, what tips and advice do you have for surviving and progressing through white belt, either on or off the mat? Whew. I say this when I talk about jiu-jitsu. I am not an expert. I have been at this for maybe a month over 2 years. I am a blue belt, which is in the grand scheme of things, and for jiu-jitsu practitioners, they're probably laughing right now, or they will be shortly, I'm sure. But in the hierarchy of the belting system, it's one past white. So what I'm trying to say is I'm a rank amateur and novice at best. So I'm probably not the best person to give you advice on this. So my first portion of the answer would be, James, is perhaps find somebody at your gym where you train who is a little bit higher up the tree who can give you better advice for longevity. Because, you know, they say on average it's 10 years to get a black belt. I think that depends largely on attendance and the person and their consistency. But talk to somebody who's a brown or a black belt or a purple belt. They've probably been at it for 4, 6, 8, 10 years. They're going to have the best advice for you. As far as what I have seen, though, I mean, I got a few things to add. I'd start with expectation management. I wouldn't put a lot of pressure on yourself, and I would go into every class with the goal of learning something and having fun. And don't worry about whether or not you win or lose, because I would say, from a mathematical perspective, starting off in jiu-jitsu, you're going to lose far, far more than you're going to win. And that should be the case. I think that speaks to the legitimacy of the art form itself. So expectation management, having a good time, trying to be a little bit better. Don't keep score of the wins and losses. And try to be a good training partner. Be the training partner that you would want to have a class with or a session with. So, and this will happen, and this has happened to me. There are people who are good training partners, and there are people who are shitting training partners, and they'll go far too rough, and they'll smash you into the mat, and they won't let you have any success. That sucks when you're on the receiving end of that. So remember that and try not to do that to other people. And I would say really that's it from my perspective. Oh, one more thing. I would focus on, and this is a personal opinion, and again, high-level jiu-jitsu practitioners, they can please correct me if you think that I'm wrong, because I am curious and very new in this. I would say focus on your defense first. I think and I feel, and I have tried to, with my own jiu-jitsu, get very comfortable in situations that are not great. You're starting off at a deficit. You're on your back. You are in the bottom of side control. You're in the bottom of mount. And you have to fight your way out of those positions. And you do that with awesome fundamentals and awesome defense. And I think if you have those two things, fundamentals and defense, I think later on, it will give you the ability to be more creative and more offensive, because you know, if you get a little spicy and you go for maybe a move that's potentially past your skill level and you end up in a bad position, no big deal, because you know how to get out of it. So I would focus on fundamentals and defense. And for those of you who have been at jiu-jitsu for longer than 2 years and a month, please feel free to tear me apart in the comments, because that's my optic. 2 years and about a month. And that is it. Hopefully that helps you. Jamie, take the long, or not Jamie, James. That's very weird. Your email at the top says Jamie, at the bottom it says James. Interesting. Take the long-term approach. Have a good time. Question number two. I am proud of my service and proud of how I led my Marines while I was in. I completed 1 9-month deployment to Iraq in 2009 as a civil affairs team leader, despite the fact that I was an artilleryman by trade. That's interesting. And I actually don't know much about either of those. Our job was basically to turn off the money faucet in Al Anbar so we could get the hell out of there. We saw zero combat, despite the fact that we went outside of the wire more days than not. Following the deployment, our unit trained like hell, and I had more near-death experiences, including a 155-millimeter round landing 70 meters from our observation post on Camp Lejeune, and one of our howitzers having an inbore detonation at Fort Bragg. Holy shit. If you don't know what a howitzer is, it's an artillery piece. And imagine the round blowing up in the actual artillery piece as opposed to flying downrange and blowing up downrange. That's gnarly. My issue is, after being so gung-ho and motivated going in, I feel like I really didn't do anything now that I am out. I got out to start my family, and I don't regret that a bit, but it's hard to explain a relatively boring military career to people when there are so many in my generation that experienced so much. I don't quite think this is the same as survivor's guilt, but it feels something similar, that feeling of I didn't do enough. Have you encountered this, and how would you recommend handling it? Semper Fi, Newman. I chose this question because I get a version of it probably every week, and I would describe it as service regret. I would describe the first question, which I get pretty often as well, as white belt lives matters, right? Most people don't care about white belts, but white belt lives matter too. This question, though, is service regret. And I get it from people who served in peacetime in between kinetic conflicts, in people who served in a wartime military, but in a non-combat capacity, or in this situation, in a capacity in a combat environment, but you didn't experience the combat in comparison to your peers. So again, that's why I call it service regret. I think the best way that I could answer your question, Newman, would be to potentially flip it on its head. So what if this narrative were reversed? You went into the military in a combat capacity in a time period where our country was at war, and you got your cup overflowed. You hit the lottery, or the unlucky lottery. I don't know what that would be described as, but you got everything you wanted and then more. And you got out of the military with the hopes of starting a family, and let's say that you did and it fell apart, or it wasn't what you wanted it to be. In either of those situations, in one, you're looking back wishing that you had done more in comparison to your peers. And in the latter situation, you would be looking back and either regretting the situation that you are currently in, or probably longing for something that had already passed itself by because you had timed out of the military. And I guess my point in saying that is there's always going to be something that you could either look back on favorably and wish you could return to that, or look back on with regret. And I think both are equally a waste of time. Because I've seen this question asked in both directions, and regret is the only thing that sits in between those two. And I think the key to letting the regret slide away, or not worry about the regret anymore, is the ability to put one thing down and move on to the next. For me, the best way to be able to do that was to stop comparing myself to my peers. The only yardstick that matters in your life, because the only person that you are going to have to measure yourself against at the end of your life is you. If I measure myself against my peers, I would fall short in every single category of every single thing that I've ever done. And I'm talking all the way back to like grade school, my ability to spell. I wasn't the best speller, probably average. Athletics, academics, the ability to shoot, move, communicate, the core competencies of being a SEAL, leadership, emotional control, combat experience. The fastest route to me to regret or to feeling like I hadn't done enough is to get a measuring stick out, but instead of measuring myself and my own improvement and what I wanted out of my military service, I measure myself against other people. And as long as you're doing that, it's going to be something that is going to be difficult for you to put down. So step one, do the best that you can to not worry about the other people that you served with during that time period, or the other people who served during that time, because there is no such thing in the military as didn't do enough. When it comes to combat, I've said this often, about 15% of the military has an occupation that is designed to indirectly engage with the enemy. And inside of that 15% of the entire United States military, I think a very small percentage of people actually get the opportunity to do so. But when they do so, and when they are successful, it is because of the efforts of everyone in the military, whether you're a weather specialist or an intelligence specialist, or you're responsible for signals or electronics or weapons or armory or ordering the bullets or flying the airplane or flying the helicopter. The military is a massive wheel, and every single one of those little spokes in the wheel is what allows it to get from point A to point B. And that's why I say there is no measurement of I didn't do enough. If you look at probably the most notable SEAL operation where they went in and they killed bin Laden. Think about all the things that had to happen for that to even take place, where they started in Virginia Beach and they ended up actioning a objective in Pakistan. The amount of aircraft required, and okay, how do the aircraft fly, you know, to get the gear from where they were in the United States over to base in Afghanistan? One, they got to have the pilots, the air crew, but the airplane has to be airworthy, right? So they have to go in there. They have to have mechanics. They're going to need spare parts. And we can go back and back and back and back until somebody is sitting in a corner office so far removed from the battlefield, but it is their job and the job of those around them that have this cascading effect that make people on the battlefield effective. You did enough. If you're in the military, if you're wearing a uniform and you get out and you worry about whether or not you did enough, you did enough. And that is it, period. Put it down and move on. 0.05% of people currently in the United States will ever wear a uniform for a living. You're part of that group already. Be proud of that. Don't let it define you. Take those experiences and go forth and do amazing things with them. Guilt is a real thing. Regret is a real thing. But they're also both optional. And like I said, first and foremost, Newman, I think in my own experience, the first step that I took away from those was to stop measuring myself against other people. And if people, you know, and people will ask you about your military experience, describe it in whatever terms that you want to, but describe it in terms that make you feel good. You know, talk about your experience and what you learned and what you were able to do. Not all military service is about combat. So not all explanations of what you did in the military need to be about combat either. Be proud of who you are and what you did. And I hope that that helps. Question number three is a three-part question. So here we go. And this is from Hema or Hema. I hope that I said that correctly. One of those two was hopefully correct. Part number one, in a world of information overload, how to have the right filters in place? Fuck, this is a good question. Actually, all three of these I think are really good, which is why I chose it. I don't think it's a matter of filters. Information overload. I am going to make an assumption that when you say information overload, we're talking about traditional streams of receiving information. So there's your Fox News and then your CNN. You know, those could sit on either side of the line on the road. Then your social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all of those things. I don't think it's a matter of filters. And I say that because I think all of those platforms and all of those avenues are already filtered. The easiest way to test this theory, which I have done, is to switch back and forth. And I'm going to use Fox News and CNN as an example. I know there are many other, but I think most people, especially in the US, will be familiar with both Fox News and CNN. Most people would say Fox News lands on the right. Most would say CNN lands on the left. Watch the coverage on an issue, one issue that is the same, and watch how each of those networks covers, talks about, and disseminates that information. I would say that it is fair to call that information already filtered from the source. So I don't think it's a matter of filtering. What I think it is it's a matter of balance. Balance how much time you are going to spend, for one, on any of those platforms, but balance where you get your information from. Have more than one touch point. I think multiple touch points would be more effective and more important than trying to look at things through a filter. So if you find an interesting piece of information, especially something that it, you know, invokes or sparks an emotional reaction in you and you want to do something about it, bounce it off of some other avenues for confirmation and to make sure that you're not having confirmation bias, that you are finding something that you are already looking for in the first place. So find balance as opposed to trying to find your filters. And I don't know a recipe or a formula for that. And I also don't want people spending their entire day on social media or traditional media. I want you out there living your life and being a contributing member of society. So balance how much time you spend doing that as well. But just don't rely on one source of information for all of the backstop of all of your thoughts and beliefs. Balance over filter. Part two, what is a better mindset option, to think clearly or to think deeply? Again, damn, good question. And the answer is both. There is a time to think clearly, and there is a time to think deeply, in my opinion. And I believe that those are based off of how much time you have available. In a moment where you need to make a decision rapidly, I would say, because of the compressed timeline, you're more in tune or more likely to find success if you focus on thinking clearly. For a more consequential or catastrophic decision, something that you need to put more thought and effort into, that is a time to think deeply. But I also think when you're in those moments, you know, if you have 2 minutes to make a decision, I would want you to think as clearly as possible, but I would also want you to use all 2 minutes. So think as clearly as you can and as deeply as the time will allow you to do so. And the other side of that is true as well. If you have time to think incredibly deeply, and it's not a compressed timeline at all, I still think that there is benefit to having clarity and conciseness in the avenues with which you consider something. If you just daydream and get nowhere, that's not going to really help you either. So there's a time and place for both, and they both should always be present. But that stopwatch or the compression or the severity of the decision and how much time you have to make it, I think defines both. So don't seek for any one of those two. Try to have both present at all times. And then lastly, at first principle level, what is the one thing you are the most certain of in the world? And this one got me thinking for a second, because I started with the thing I'm the most certain of is that we're going to die, that everybody's going to die. But I'm not sure that meets the criteria of at being at first principle level. So I thought about it a little bit more. And what I believe at a very, very deep level is that both good and evil truly exist. I think that most people have the capacity for both, but they float largely in the middle or towards the good side of the house. I think that there are people in the world who, by every definition of the word, by every definition of the action, the thought, the motivation, are evil to the absolute core. And I think there are other people who are good or pure to the absolute core as well. And I've seen both. With my travels in the military to the places that I went, we were seeking out, in my opinion, those who were on the evil side of the spectrum. And it felt awesome to take them off the chessboard, because you can, I almost said taste it, and I don't know why, because I've never tried to eat one of these people, but you can feel it when they look at you. You can feel the hatred and the evil when you lock whites of the eyes with these people. It truly does exist. And I'm so thankful that most people never have to experience that or go into a room like that or be party or privy to that. But that doesn't mean that it's out there. And I'm really glad that there are other people who at their core are amazing human beings who are empathetic and inspirational and truly care about others more than themselves and that truly want to make a difference in the world. And I'm glad that they balance themselves out. And I hope that people don't put blinders on and forget that both ends of the spectrum are there. And also don't forget, like I said at the beginning, I'm pretty positive that most people have capacity for good and evil, but they're morally trend on the good side of the house. But that doesn't mean you should assume that they're not capable of doing some pretty horrendous things. Never underestimate your enemy, because your enemy is out there. And that's what I am one of the most certain things of in the world for myself, my own experience. Last question. Whew, and this one is a doozy. So I saved it for last. I have no idea how I'm doing on my 5-minute timeline, because I'm not keeping track today. Here we go. I'm 21 years old and living at home. This started out due to my decision to stop pursuing a degree in mechanical engineering. When I found a job, it was mere minutes from my parents' home, so I moved back in. Since then, I have decided on a path that I want to pursue, but a new challenge has arisen. My father has become a serious alcoholic since the death of his only two father figures. And at my mother's request, I am staying at home to provide some safety and stability for her and my younger brother. With his naturally narcissistic personality, he does not see his behavior as a problem. He willingly admits that he drinks too much, but feels that if anyone has an issue with it, it isn't his problem. I have offered to go to counseling, therapy, and even just sat and listened to him explain why he doesn't want to address this issue in our lives. It has effectively strangled all positive growth in our household, and I am unsure of what to do. My mother is unwilling to give him any sort of ultimatum, but because of his actions, is currently struggling with her own mental health. We are all, but only my brother and I are, we are all, sorry, meaning he's struggling with their mental health, but only my brother and I are doing anything about it. I'm in the process of trying to find an alcohol addiction counselor that I can meet with to try and address this and gain insight. I know you have faced challenges with alcohol from the other side and have had your own personal struggles. So with that in mind, what actions, changes, or resources would you recommend accessing? Are there any perspectives or considerations I could adopt that might improve the situation? Any advice or guidance would be greatly appreciated. Thank you for your time. I wish you and the family all the best. I'm going to leave your name out of this one completely. And I'm going to start with saying I'm not by any means qualified to give you professional advice on this. I can give you my opinion, and that is all that it should count for, right? I am not a professional in this realm. I have never been an alcoholic. I enjoy drinking, but for me, I can turn alcohol on and off. And I was just, I forget who I was talking with about this recently, but I truly don't think that I have an addictive personality. I can turn it off, have fun with it, drink quite a bit in a short period of time, and then shut it off. So I can't speak from the perspective of an alcoholic. And if I've actually given that impression that I was an alcoholic at some time, then that's a poor usage of my own words. So I apologize for that. I have had, I don't know if I would call them struggles, but a journey down a rabbit hole after I got hurt dealing with some pain mitigation. But what I was dealing with sounds a little bit different than what your father is dealing with. And I'll start by saying, I'm really sorry that you're in this situation because it is difficult. And I think the advice that you are going to get from a professional, and I hope that you do go find a professional and seek their advice, none of it is going to be easy. I think you need to sit down. The one thing that I didn't see in your email, and as I was reading it, I didn't hear is, have you sat down and had a man-to-man conversation with your father about his actions and been very, very clear about how they are making you feel and the impact that they are having on your family? I would start there. I would sit down in a moment of sobriety with your father, no alcohol around, and do not allow alcohol during the conversation, and explain to him very, very clearly how his actions are making you feel and how they're impacting your mother and your younger brother. During the course of that conversation, you know, if you think that he has been driven to drink since the death of his only two father figures, I would ask him directly, and I don't know their names, but I would, you know, let's say Joe and Bob. Hey, Dad, how do you think Joe and Bob would respond to your behavior since their passing? Do you think that they would approve of your behavior, or do you think that they would have a problem with it? And if they had a problem with it, what do you think that they would tell you to do? I would put it back on your dad. As far as resources, Al-Anon is an organization that I have absolutely no experience with, but I have heard it come up over and over and over again. And from my understanding, it is an organization that helps people who are peripheral to an alcoholic deal with that relationship. Again, I have no personal experience with it, but it has come up so many times in conversation. And when it has come up from the perspective of really helping that individual that went to Al-Anon. And oftentimes it was not the person who was drinking in these conversations that I have had. So that would be one resource or reference that I would perhaps push you towards. And you're already looking for an addiction counselor, I would go down that direction as well. But again, start with you having a conversation with your dad. Seek out these professionals. And the last piece of advice that I think might be helpful, and again, I'm not a professional, so take this advice with a grain of salt, is I would consider having a family intervention. Before doing that, though, I would get everybody in your family together and I would speak to them first. And I would develop a game plan. And then only after everybody is on board, and assuming that everybody is on board, would I approach your father. Again, in a moment of sobriety. And if you go the ultimatum route, which I think you may need to in this situation, what I would say about that is don't throw out an ultimatum that you're not prepared to action. If you do go down the ultimatum route, you need to be prepared to live every inch of that ultimatum. And if that doesn't work, if you go that path and it doesn't work, I would say you have some tough, really tough questions ahead of you. The first one would be, is the environment that your mother and younger brother living in safe? It sounds like potentially not. And if it's not safe, you have even tougher decisions ahead of you. Because in that equation, there is one side of that equation that is very negative, and it is detrimental to the other side. And at some point in time, you're going to have to do something to balance it out. And I don't, you know, the options are going to be up to you. I don't know anything about the specifics, if there's other family, if there are other resources around. But at some point in time and in some way, actions are going to need to be taken to balance out the insidious nature of that equation. And hopefully that can come from your dad taking the actions himself. But if it doesn't, you may need to, and I'm sorry that you're in this position at 21 years old, because you've got a ton of road ahead of you, and the life experience that you will have 5, 10, 20 years down the road would help prepare you to deal with these things. And I'm sorry that you would have to at 21, but you might have to make some very difficult life choices. And I wish you the best of luck. That really sucks to hear the situation that you were in. But hopefully, at least a little bit of that advice is helpful for you. Now, to Twitter, to end this. What time is it? I'm going to give myself 5 minutes again. Of course, I enter my phone password incorrectly. All right, we're starting at the bottom of Twitter. We're going to go rapid fire. Recommended rifle for the militiaman based on ammunition, effectiveness, durability, and affordability, with a follow-up question on how to set it up for home and personal defense. Probably the most accessible common round is going to be a 5.56 round. So you're looking at an AR platform. I would put something on an AR. You know, iron sights are just fine, but if you want to have a little bit of magnification, don't get crazy. A 4-power ACOG would probably be good to go. Even an EOTech with a holographic sight would probably be good for anything out to a few hundred yards, which is about the maximum effective range. How to set it up for home and personal defense: put a light on that bad boy so you can illuminate your target. Make sure you have the ability to see your sights in any light condition. Make sure you have ammunition. Store it in a safe location. And also, do a little bit of a surveying of your house. What's a great fallback position? If all the bedrooms are upstairs and everything else is downstairs, consider, you know, posting up at the top of the stairs. And if somebody tries to steal your TV, let them steal your TV. It's not that important. At what point does America bring the troops home? We don't bring the troops home. The troops haven't really been home for a very extended period of time. We still have troops in Korea. We still have troops in Japan. We still have troops in Europe. They are going to be all over the world globally, probably as long as the United States exists. What I think is a better question would be, what should be the criteria and threshold with which we commit American lives to actions outside of the forward locations that they are currently staged in the interest of the United States? What is my best snatch and clean and jerk? For those of you who don't know what that means, they're both Olympic lifts. A clean and jerk comes from the ground. Usually you catch it in a full squat, stand up, and then get it over your head. That is with a narrower grip. A snatch is a really wide grip, and you go all the way from the ground. You generally will get underneath it and then stand up. I think my best clean and jerk was in the high twos, and then I think my best snatch was like 205 pounds, which, and those numbers, by the way, people are, they're Bush League shit. Andy, are you going to have Johnny Kim on the podcast in the near future? I would love to. It depends on whether or not I can get a hold of him. What is my favorite part of the 4-mile timed run? How about right before it and right after it? Fuck the 4-mile timed run. I'm not interested in any portion of it that is the during portion. All right. Do two more. Why has Gators not made a tactical monocle already? And why is Dan Crenshaw, Texas, which is obviously the congressman from Texas, why is he not modeling it? Well, they haven't made the tactical monocle yet because they're not ready to really explode into the marketplace. You know, they to do that, to make the tactical monocle, they're going to have to put a supply chain into effect that's going to involve probably multiple countries mining all of their precious minerals just in order to satisfy the demand of people that I believe would want a monocle. Dan Crenshaw, Texas would be the perfect example of that. I want a monocle as well. Hopefully they'll get on board and make one shortly. Find the dude in your intro and do a podcast with him. Already working on that. I haven't heard you talk much about flying as a pilot in command, and I'm curious about that. What is your favorite type of aircraft to fly? What are your memorable experiences what are some memorable experiences you've had whilst in the air as PIC, which stands for pilot in command? I actually don't know why, and I'll end it on this because I'll go into depth a little bit. I don't know why I don't talk about flying much, other than probably I don't have the opportunity to do it anymore. I have just over 3,000 flight hours. I was very fortunate enough to meet some people early on who shepherded me through an aviation career. I started off with my private pilot's license, then I got my multi-engine rating, then my commercial multi. And then when I got my type rating in a Citation 525S, which means single pilot, I got my ATP as well. So I actually have the same pilot's license as the guys flying the old big old airplanes, the Delta and more, whoever you may fly, American, fill in the blank. I am type rated in a Gulfstream G4. And the, like I said, the 525 series aircraft, I think that actually covers 6 of the Citation models. And I've got about 1,500 hours in a Cirrus SR-22 Turbo. Best experiences while flying. The freedom of flying is hard to describe. It's a lot like riding in the back of the airplane, but you can change the view however you want to. And it's really cool to be able to do that. If you want to go check something out, you can go check something out. It's very checklist-based. It's very routine-based. I enjoy that because it went right back to the stuff I was doing inside of the military. Obviously, a different utilization of checklist and routine, but I picked it up quickly because of that. Coolest places to fly, though. I flew a bunch to Hawaii. Landing in Turks and Caicos was pretty awesome, but then also landing in a blizzard in Boston was pretty sweet. The Gulfstream had a heads-up display that I was able to use. I enjoyed an understanding of the systems and just the ability to kind of go and do whatever you wanted to do and the people that I got to meet while flying. So those were my favorite things about it. And again, it's not something that I avoid. It's just something that I don't have the chance to do. I'm no longer current on any of those aircrafts or on flying in general. So I don't really feel the need to talk about it much. And it's actually not something that I think about very much. And that, ladies and gents, is it for this Friday. See you Monday with another episode, this one obviously being an interview with my good friend, John Barklow.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller. Find your next obsession. Or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first 3 audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.